itself is not iambic, and you have to have the electronic key, which is what makes it iambic. They also make different combinations of straight key, pedal, and bug. They're not cheap, but it is mounted on one base. However, there are lots of places that you can pick up individual keys. Still a lot of straight keys around, available at different flea markets. And there's a good organization, the Straight Key Century Club, skcc.org, I believe, is their website, and they have a link on there where some guys actually have keys that are available free of charge to people who are interested in learning, particularly straight key or manually generated Morse code. But the code is very popular, and like you said, Dick, certain words are musical. You mentioned bent. There's a phrase, bend, best bent wire. If you send that, it actually sounds like a little musical tone, a song or something. So, but it is a lot of fun, and that's all I do on HF is CW. Back to that.
Give me that phrase one more time. Bend, best bent wire. Was that the sentence combination that's got this good swing to it, Rich? K2UPS, K2LIW.
That's correct. If you send it, you'll hear it. You'll notice the musical intonations right away.
Okay, I heard that as bend, best, bent, wire. I'll have to try that one. I can see it coming. Okay. Morse code can be a lot of fun for people who appreciate it. And it's a mode that gets through very well under weak conditions, with a slight exception. When it comes to microwave communication, a really cleanly sent single sideband message that's repeated on an extremely weak microwave signal. I've done the experiment multiple times of comparing Morse code to the repeated sideband voice communication. And I think I get a little bit better threshold of information rate out of a well-sent sideband, really clean sideband, on a microwave event. Doesn't necessarily mean the same as HF because of the very different kinds of noise and where the noise is coming from. So Morse code, most of the time, gives you the weakest possible signal, but not always. The real weakest possible signal are the the digital modes, all of them, I can't think of his call letters. KC2WGB, to bring me up to date, K2IW. Go ahead, John.
I guess you were talking about Joe Taylor. Okay, we've got to go over to Paul. It's getting late, so we're crunching his time. But that's it from the mailbag, and thank you for the questions and all your participation. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Okay, at this time we go over to the famous space section of the TechNet. This will be space report number 229 of the series. And Paul W2N is going to give that to us. And before I do, Paul, I'm bringing to your attention the December issue of Scientific American Magazine, December 2016. And on page 22, there's an interesting little section here about the quick hits, it's called, and what they said that in China, an announcement from Chinese officials seemed to confirm that the country's space agency had lost control of its Tiangong-1 space station, which has been in low Earth orbit since 2011 and was last occupied in 2013. Let me drop. The 8.5 metric ton spacecraft will most likely fall to Earth in the late 2017. Experts predict it will largely burn up on re-entering the atmosphere. So once again, the announcement from the Chinese officials seemed to confirm that the Tiangong-1 spacecraft, they no longer have control of it. They have lost control of it. You probably already knew that, Paul, but reading it in Scientific American struck me as striking. WS2N with the space report. K2IW in the TechNet. You got Paul. Wait for the beep.
This is WS2N. And yeah, Tangong Wong, that was probably about 6 or 8 months ago, I remember they lost control of that, so it's going to be anybody's guess of where it's going to hit. But they do, I think most of it will burn up. But yeah, they haven't been worried about that. In fact, since then, they've launched Tangong 2, which is the second space station. They've sent the crew up there, too. Lasted a month, 32-day flight, 30, you know, the whole flight, getting there and leaving. And they have returned. And now in April, they're going to send up what we consider a progress type of ship, their own design, dock with that station, practice fueling. There's no plans of sending any other crews to that station. But Tangong Wong, the one that's out of control, yeah, they had sent two different crews up there a couple of years ago. But that thing is been tumbling in space for quite a while. Let me drop it. Their ultimate goal is to get to the third generation space station, which would be the first section, will be launched next year. Let's see, 2018 would be the first time they'll launch the first section. And then they should have completed around 2022, 2023, about four or five different modules they plan on attaching up there. But the first one will be going up in about a year and a half. And that'll be going up on a new Long March 5 heavy lift vehicle from their new spaceport along the water. Going to the China Sea, unlike what they do now, they launch on land, and then the boost is going to actually come down on land, similar to what the Russians do. Let me drop. So that's the story for the year. I just want to pick up where we left off last week with these internet satellites that everybody's got planned on launching there. The one that we talked about, the Google one, I haven't really read about that one, but I knew about the SpaceX one that was planned. And sure enough, on the 15th of this month, they just filed with the FCC to get an okay to launch over 4,400 satellites collectively. They want to start off with around 1,000 of them. And they want to put them into 600 and 700 mile high orbits. To do that, you're going to increase the amount of satellites that are in space tremendously. But they put a request in to start doing this. They have a manufacturing plant they set up in Seattle to manufacture these satellites like cars. And the belief of SpaceX is actually there's more money in the manufacturing of the satellites than there is actually launching them. So they're into that. Any kind of an opportunity to make more money for his ultimate goal of going to Mars, that's something Elon Musk does. So this is going to be a $10 billion project just by, from SpaceX to ultimately create an internet. And by the way, they have a situation where they're going to have homes and buildings with portable antennas for like $300 attached to your house. Phased array antennas that are going to contact your satellites. I still haven't figured out how much power you're going to.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
How could I time out so quick? WS2N. Okay, so, I just want to start out with that. We'll see. I don't know when they want to start on this, but they just put the request in for the FCC. So, my guess is probably a year or two before they do anything, they have to get the approval first. Want to talk about the beam. That's the Bigelow Expandable Activity Module that's attached to the International Space Station. An update on that. They have all kinds of sensors in that. That's the one that is attached to the space station, and it was very small when it did. When it was attached, and now it's blown up. They blew it up about three times its size. And they've had many times that they've opened the door and gone inside, checked all these different sensors, radiation sensors, vibration sensors, leak, temperature, humidity, and everything has been coming back very good. That was this information that was released by NASA. So looks like Robert Bigelow has a winner on his hands. His ultimate goal now is to have a larger inflatable module to also attach to the International Space Station. If he gets approval from NASA, he's already got to deal with United Launch Alliance, which is a combination of Lockheed and Boeing, to launch another vehicle on an Atlas V rocket. So, I wouldn't be surprised if 3 or 4 years down the road he has another much larger unit called the BA330 cubic meters attached to the space station. If NASA doesn't allow it, he wants to create a standalone space station where you can put one or two of these things up, or eventually more. He'll start off with two, and he'll have his own commercial space station. And that won't be for probably, if they do that, I wouldn't be surprised if, 6 to 8 years down the road. Another thing I wanted to cover was the Cygnus spacecraft, the resupply vehicle that went up to the ISS. That was sent up in October. They unloaded over 5,000 pounds worth of supplies to the space station, and then loaded it up with trash and junk that gets burnt up because this thing does not come back to Earth. It eventually burns up over the Pacific Ocean. They de-earthed that thing from the Earth-facing port off of the space station. Successfully brought it to a higher orbit. The reason for doing that is they wanted to release 4 CubeSats, which they did successfully. They've done this before with Cygnus, resupply craft after deorbiting from the space station. They've always stayed at the same altitude. Now they went up an extra 100 miles higher to release the CubeSats. Instead of CubeSats only having a life of, say, 7 or 8 months, they'll live for over 2 years. So they did that, and they have another fire test on board. They have different materials inside Cygnus, and from the ground, they light them up, and they want to see how having a large fire inside of one of these modules, how it affects different materials on board, and how to extinguish it, that type of thing. So this is the second of that testing system that they're doing. They did that on the last resupply mission, and they'll do one more on the next one, which will be going up probably in the spring of next year. And that one will be going up on an Atlas V rocket instead of the Antares rocket from Virginia, like the last one that had gone up. Let me drop it. SpaceX, I expect them to start relaunching their Falcon 9 vehicles. They've been out of commission since September 1st when they had the explosion on Launch Complex 40. And since then, they've been investigating it. NASA's been investigating it. The Air Force, everybody that's involved. And they've managed to duplicate the explosion in McGregor, Texas. McGregor, Texas is where SpaceX has their facilities testing rockets and all. They apparently duplicated this. People, you know, miles away from the plant heard a loud explosion the other day, and fire department was called out unnecessarily, though. It was a planned explosion. And now that they've pinpointed that, last I read was that SpaceX was planning on launching probably the end of, or sometime during December, I guess the end of December. Their first rocket out of California would be the next flight out of Vandenberg Air Force Base. Which they've done that before. I'd like to see them get a successful landing, though. They'll probably try to land there faster again. And this time, you know, from California, they've done it a number of times from Florida, but not yet from Vandenberg. So there's other launches going up. There's a Delta 4 launch, a military flight going up next month. Then internationally, India has a launch on a TSLV. That's the Pulse satellite launch vehicle that they use. One of the two different types of rockets that India uses. They'll be putting one up. They've had quite a few flights this year, including one that went to Mars. India has a spacecraft orbiting Mars right now. Let me drop it. Still operating. Actually, they launched it at the end of last year. And that's very successful. So, you know, they have another rocket that they use, the GSLV. That's a bigger one. They've launched that even four or five times this year. So they're quite active. Japan, they have a launch coming up actually within a week or two. Let's see, that would probably be, I think that was the 9th or 10th of December. And they're launching from Japan on their rocket. They have a H-2B rocket, which is bigger than the H-2A. But that's the one that they launched for NASA. Actually for themselves, too, because they're part of the European Space Agency. And what they'll be launching is the sixth version of the HTV. Yeah. It's their cargo vehicle that goes to the space station, which brings them a lot of, most of it. What Russia brings up, or even what SpaceX brings up, around 10,000 or more pounds dropped. And that should be going up in December. They've done this 5 times in the past, usually an average of once a year. And they'll be doing it again this December. It's been delayed probably about 4 or 5 months. It was supposed to go up a while back. They had a leak in there. In their spacecraft, and they had to disassemble a lot of stuff to fix that leak, and that's pretty much it. There's other things, but we won't continue on. We'll turn it back to you, Dick. This is WSTN for the space portion of the technical net, and by the way, I can always be reached at my email at spacenetreport@gmail.com. Back to you, Dick. K2RIWWS.
Thank you, Paul. And there's more going to follow here, I can tell. The December issue of Scientific American not only does it have that article about Tangong 1, it's got a beautiful 1-2-3-page article on the European Space Agency spacecraft called Gaia, G-A-I-A. And what's unique about Gaia is that It was launched in 2013. It's in its second year of operation, and it has just published the information on 1 billion stars in our local galaxy. What Gaia is trying to do is to measure the distance and velocity of the nearest 1 billion stars, such that you can now get a three-dimensional view of our local galaxy stars, up to numbers like 6 or 10,000 light years. So the stars that are nearby, the nearest 1 billion stars, you're going to be, by way of Gaia's data gathering, know with extremely high accuracy, 24 micro arc seconds the accuracy. 24 micro arc seconds of azimuth and elevation, so to speak, right ascension and declination error. And it can also recognize stars down to 5 micro arc seconds. If I take 1 degree of azimuth or elevation and divide it down by 60, I've now got a minute of arc. If I divide that by 60, I've got a second of arc. If I now divide that by 1 million, I've got a micro arc second. We're talking about 24 micro arc seconds means 1 part in 150 million is what we're talking about here.
But repeater, timeout.
So Gaia is giving you information on the nearest 10 billion stars, or 1 billion stars, so you know the exact position and exact velocities. So you get a real dynamic three-dimensional picture, is what Gaia is trying to give us. The European Space Agency can recognize things down to 5 microarc seconds. That means that something the size of the sun could easily be recognized by this thing at 6,500 light years. The camera on board has 1 billion pixels. The quote here is that the Gaia photographing capability is 50 times higher in resolution than the Hubble Space Telescope. The amount of light gathering primary mirror is 30 times greater than the Hipparchus satellite. The number of times Gaia will observe each of its individual 1 billionth target is 70 times. So it's looking for temporal changes. In other words, the rate at which a star moves will be measured 70 times 1 billion stars. And Gaia's spacecraft distance from Earth is 1.5 million kilometers. I think that means it's really at Lagrange point number 2. It's roughly 1 million miles away from the Earth. On the back side of the Earth, away from the sun, is where Gaia is mounted. So that is one high-performance spacecraft. I don't know the size of the mirror on it. I'd like to know the size of the mirror compared to Hubble. Hubble, I think, is 94 inches, something like 2.4 meters in diameter. I wonder if you happen to know the size of the mirror on the Gaia spacecraft, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
I remember when it went up, but I thought it was about half the diameter. The Gaia spacecraft had problems early on. One of that article mentioned that. Apparently they must have worked things out if it's now operational. They had problems for about a year or so. They mentioned that they had that the thing was not working, and then apparently now it is working. It's good to hear. And yeah, I know it's out at Lagrange point number 2. It was launched by, I believe that was launched by Soyuz rocket, but one of the ones that are owned by European Space Agency. I realize it's nothing to do with the Russians anymore. That's the medium range launcher. So good that they got that thing working. I believe they had problems with that. Back to
this. This beautiful three-page article in Scientific American, starting on page number 14, doesn't mention the problems. The website does. I just went to the website and it talks about the early problems, but they must have ironed them out because they have just published a catalog of 1 billion stars in something like 10,000 scientific people have already accessed that particular website. 1 billion stars, exact locations and velocities and sizes and whatever, have been published, and that, and once every year, that catalog is going to be updated. The resolution capability of Gaia, G-A-I-A, I pronounce it Gaia, maybe it's Gaia, it can recognize an object 5 micro arc seconds. That is equivalent to half the size of a dime on the surface of the moon viewed from the surface of the Earth. So if you're on the surface of the Earth, if there was no atmosphere, and you're looking at half the size of a dime on the surface of the moon, that is the angular resolution capability of this Gaia spacecraft. I think they did it not by way of a bigger mirror. I think they did it by way of a more elaborate camera, a 1 billion pixel camera. That camera has 50 times more angular resolution than Hubble. An amazing spacecraft. Let me drop it. When you see a picture of Gaia, it looks like a spacecraft that would be something you'd put in synchronous orbit, and it's sitting in the middle of this very large disk. And that disk does not look like it has a parabolic shape. So I'm kind of confused as to what that disk is doing, Paul. Maybe you know. And the disk has, it looks like a multi-meter diameter disk with about 10 little sections of it that are slightly different in color. So what is that great big disk doing? Maybe that disk is simply a shield aimed in the direction of Earth to make sure it's not seeing any stray light from anything. Maybe it's a little bit like the Webb spacecraft, the Webb telescope, which has 5 layers of shields between it and Earth and the sun to make sure it doesn't pick up any excess heat. So, any idea what that great big disk that the Gaia is mounted on? What's that doing, Paul? WS2N, KGYW?
Yeah, I thought that was the one with the mask type of thing over the glass before it went down to the CC, the camera. But I don't remember. I'd have to look into it. That was, I remember when this thing went up. We had it on the net. It was actually net 153 back in November. June, and 2 years ago, back in 2015. I have it on my report. I can search for that. Very good. I'm glad they got a work. You know, the pronunciation. I go by the news conferences that they have. They had a guy from Knesset, C-N-E-S. That's the French version of NASA. They have all the different people that get interviewed when these things go up. And that's what they were saying. Back to you, Dick.
The Milky Way galaxy contains approximately 100 billion stars, 10 to the 11th stars. Gaia is going to give you exact positions and velocities of 1 billion stars. So 10% of the whole darn Milky Way is going to be, with high resolution of position and velocity, is going to be cataloged by Gaia at the end of its mission. And they hope that Gaia will discover thousands of extra planets, I guess by looking at the wiggle and occultation of those stars by way of the planets. So as Gaia gathers more data, they intend to find thousands of planets on these 1 billion stars that is making a three-dimensional map of as to their position and velocity. So you're eventually going to be able to make a computer-generated graphic, which is a little bit like what we've seen on Star Trek, which was pure fiction, of course. Let me drop it. Star Trek would lead you to believe that they go zooming through space and you see the stars go swishing by. For that to be real, let me give you an idea. One of the articles that I saw by Neil deGrasse Tyson, and I don't think he originated, but at least he made it pop by one of his YouTube videos. Let me give you a little bit of an idea of how the universe of stars are laid out. If you counted all the grains of sand on planet Earth, you'd come up with an estimated number of 10 to the 18. So there's more grains of sand on planet Earth than there are stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Milky Way galaxy, 10 to the 11. 10 to the 18 grains on Earth, so that means 10 to the 7. You've got 10 billion times more grains of sand on Earth than you do stars in our galaxy. But that's a hell of a lot less than the total number of stars in the observable universe. 10 to the 11 galaxies, 10 to the 11 stars per galaxy, 10 to the 22 stars are in the observable universe. Rough numbers. Let me drop. If you wanted to use each of the grains of sand, and maybe a average grain of sand on planet Earth is something like 0.2 millimeters in diameter. So if you take each of the grains of sand and make believe that each grain of sand represents a star in our Milky Way galaxy, you could do that. So you can take 10 to the 11 grains of sand, a certain percentage of the sand that's on planet Earth, and you're going to arrange it in three-dimensional space exactly equal to this catalog of 1 billion stars that Gaia is coming up with. So you're going to arrange these grains of sand in three-dimensional space, suspending them by strings or wires or whatever. The average spacing between the grains, each grain of sand represents the diameter of the average size of a star. So each grain of sand represents a star. And you see there's a huge ratio between the size of a grain of sand and the size of something like the sun. But assuming that the sun is an average-sized star, and it's close, and assume that the average size of a grain of sand is around 0.2 millimeters, and you're going to make this map, this three-dimensional map, each of those grains of sand would have to be 3 miles apart to be scaled to the star spacing in our galaxy. Let me repeat that. You take 10 billion grains of sand from planet Earth, displace them in three-dimensional space, so that the average spacing between the grains of sand is 3.5 miles. That will be a reasonable representation in scale for our galaxy. To say that there's a lot of space between the stars, it gives you a little bit of a feeling for what's going on. To say there's a lot of stars with a huge amount of spacing. Average star spacing is something like 4.5 light years. Alpha Centauri or Beta, what is it now called? I'm going to call it Alpha Centauri, I think it is. Proxima Centauri, the nearest star to us, which, by the way, they recently discovered it's got a planet, is 4.5 light years from us. It's close to the average spacing between the stars. So two grains of sand, 3.5 miles apart, would represent the space between us, to size scale of size of star and spacing between the two, 3.5 miles of spacing between two grains of sand. To say space is empty is quite an understatement. You probably read that analogy before, Paul. I was kind of amazed that this week when I read it. WS2N, K2RIW.
No, I didn't read it. It's about the sand. Back to being 3 miles apart now. Very good, though. Very good. Okay, now I was just going up for the net that we did a couple of years ago on this Gaia, and at that time it wasn't fixed. Some kind of refraction light going over. They have a 10-meter sunshade on this thing. Apparently light was creeping over the edges. Also, there was some frost or something that got into the inside of the tent, and light would bounce off of that and into the detector. So they must have figured out a way to stop all that. But no, that's a good analogy. It's amazing. There's a little sand in the beach, and it's I heard that when I was a kid, and it's still unbelievable today. That's even possible. And back then, they didn't even know there were as many galaxies as we have. Now it's even more so.
Yeah, as we put up better and better telescopes with better and better cameras, we're getting more and more of a view of how big the galaxy is, how many billions of light years, how many billions of years ago was the Big Bang. I think the current number is 13.8 billion years ago was the Big Bang. That number keeps increasing as they make more and more measurements. And a lot of people think that estimating the number of grains of sand on planet Earth is out of the question. Not at all. Once you understand exponential mathematics, you go to your Jones Beach, pick up a cup of sand, put it under your microscope, start measuring what's the average size of a grain of sand. And you go to various kinds of soil with various kinds of sand, and you come up with an average. It's around 0.2 millimeter. Let me think now. A millimeter is roughly 40 thousandths of an inch. 0.2 times that, 1/5. So I guess about 4 thousandths of an inch is the average size grain of sand in that neighborhood. And so what's the number of cubic meters or cubic miles of sand on your local beach? You can estimate that. And how many beaches are there on the land, of the perimeter of land masses that are close to the ocean? You can estimate that. Let me drop. So by exponential mathematics, you just add up the exponents, and you've got a good approximation. You could easily be 10 to 1 wrong, but it's close enough. There's many a case where knowing the right ballpark, as I've often given as an example, you're using the holes to pick up, to fill up your pool. Somebody has just repaired your pool, and you're not going to use your garden hose to fill up the pool. And so, at first you say, well, let's turn on the hose, and a few hours later the pool's going to be full. Well, you do a good estimate as to how many gallons per hour can flow out of your garden hose. And you may come to the conclusion that your wife wants the pool in good operation, but the party is going to happen tomorrow. And by a back of the envelope, you may calculate that it takes 2 weeks with that particular garden hose to fill up your pool, if it's a good size of pool. So knowing orders of magnitude, is it 2 hours, 2 days, or 2 weeks? That's awful nice to know. And so exponential mathematics allows you to make estimates like this. And knowing your rough approximation, order of magnitude, in other words, the nearest 10 to 1 ratio, in many situations, it lets you know at the beginning of a project, is it possible or impossible? Should we keep spending money on this one, or are we way beyond the laws of physics here? Estimation of order of magnitude at times really give you that information. Another example that I use, it'd be very nice to say that if I build up my muscles strong enough, I'll eventually be able to flap my hands fast enough and fly. You do a back-of-the-envelope calculation of how much wing area it takes to lift up a 160-pound, 180-pound human being. I mean, it was done with the Gossamer Condor. It's a 110-foot wingspan airplane, man-powered, made out of the most exotic materials you can find, graphite-reinforced spars and thin mylar film over the wing as the covering. Build that Gossamer Condor. I seem to remember it's roughly a 150-pound airplane. And you put a 150-pound airplane human being in there, like Mr. Brian Allen, who's a very good sailplane pilot, and he on an ergometer can turn out a third of a horsepower for an hour. So you put him inside this man-powered airplane, operating the bicycle pedals, turning out a third of a horsepower, and he can fly a figure-eight mile path, just barely, with a 110-foot wingspan. So you think you're going to do that by flapping your hands? I mean, you could make yourself a progress chart. Hey, I've jumped off the chair to do some flying, and I flapped my hands, and today I flew for 5 feet. Tomorrow I flew for 5.2 feet. I can see progress. And you make a chart and you say, hey, at the rate I'm going, in 10 years I'll be able to fly. My muscles are going to be getting stronger. And by way of the Gossamer Condor, 110-foot wingspan, out of the exotic materials, the best strength-to-weight ratio materials you got, and the thing just barely flies. You think you're going to do that? You're way beyond the laws of physics. You couldn't flap. Your hands would have to go at almost supersonic speeds, if you know what I mean. Your muscles are not going to allow you to do it. So there are certain things.
Well, you... Repeater, time out.
As a scientist, there are certain things that you do as a approximation, order of magnitude, can easily let you know should you continue pursuing that particular project. Or is it 10 to 1 or 100 to 1 or 1,000 to 1 beyond the laws of physics? So, for a human being to fly on his own hand power, not a chance. Not even a human being 1,000 years from now is going to be able to do that. A bird does that by very exotic engineering. You know, extremely hollow bones, very strong muscles, very strong rib cage, great big wings with these exotic things called feathers. You look at a feather under a microscope, and you realize how elaborate that thing is. There's a lot of fancy engineering that went into that, if you know what I mean. Depending on whether you think in a secular manner or a spiritual manner, the evolution we consider a bird a reptile. How in the world a reptile slowly evolved into something we call a bird? There's a lot of steps in between that, not easy to explain. So, there's an awful lot of empty space between those stars. There's a huge amount of distance. It's the most powerful rocket we've got. And you think you're going to travel to that planet that we've recently discovered, going around the nearest star, Proxima Centauri, 4 1/3 or whatever it is, light years away. I mean, the fastest thing a human being has ever launched is the Voyager spacecraft. And it would get to Proxima Centauri in what? 10 centuries or something like that? I bet you there's been an estimation on that one, Paul. How long would it take for Voyager, at its current speed, the fastest thing we have ever issued, to get to the nearest star? WS2N, K2RW. I think you gave us that info one time, Paul.
Yeah, it was around 38,000 years. So that's not going to happen anytime soon. Even with the baseline system that we're building in. If you put a couple of thousand pounds on top of, you know, maybe you'll be able to get faster than the Voyager, but, just, you know, even if you cut the speed in half, it'll be 20,000 years. So, we're not going to get there anytime soon. Voyager, by the way, is up to 137, going on 138 AU. The other one, I think it's around 112 or 113 or something. Oh, wait, I think it was 117. I think it was up to 117. I'll have to check. But, that's only, you know, 137 times the distance between the Earth and the Sun. Pluto is, what, 39? So roughly every 10 or 11 years, probably every 11 and a half years or so, it covers the distance between the Sun and Pluto. So here it is only, you know, let's see, 4 times or so the distance of Pluto. Got a long way to go to get to Alpha Centauri. Proxima Centauri, not equal. When I was a kid, it was Alpha Centauri. Back to you.
Joe recognized. Since you said it's 137 astronomical units up to 138, I estimate 137.8. At 93 million miles between us and the Sun, that's an astronomical unit. It turns out to be 12.8.
Repeater, time out.
That turns to be 12.8 billion miles. My goodness, is that down the road a bit? Voyager's way out there.
Dick, how many AUs a year is that? That it's traveling?
Paul's going to tell us. Paul, how many AUs a year?
John, 3.5, Dick.
3.5 AUs per year. So it's stacking them up real fast. Joe, W-A-2-L-I-Y, make sure you wait for the... Beach. Go right ahead, Joe.
Only single beep. Yeah, you talk about Voyager quite a bit there, Dick. I don't recall recently, well, I never have listened to every particular tech man in space with the in the tail end. I never heard you ever mention the sensitivity of the receiving equipment on that spacecraft minus the gain of the antenna. Even at the narrowest bandwidth that the receiver is capable of being operated into, you know, operated in, with the technology what it was back going, what, about 40 years ago, I think, they launched this thing, give or take. What is the ultimate lowest sensitivity that thing can possibly receive? Because that is a finite number. Am I correct?
Remember, it's a 12-foot dish when you figure it out.
At least three times in the last year and a half, I've gone through that calculation, Joe. 12-foot dish, I think the number was like 48 dB of gain, or 68. It's a big number. Radiating something like 10 watts of power, being received by a 240-foot dish at Goldstone, California, backed up with a cryogenically cooled low-noise amplifier, probably cooled to 10 degrees Kelvin. And the actual signal strength, this Voyager gets, let me drop it. See, Voyager is only radiating 10 watts, but we're picking it up with cryogenically cooled front end, super low noise figure. And we told Voyager to send the data to us at something like 50 bits per second by using a very fancy phase lock loop receiver at Goldstone. They have a 50 hertz, 50 cycle bandwidth IF strip, you could say, in order to make the signal narrow enough to hear Voyager. For Voyager to hear Goldstone is a hell of a lot easier. Goldstone radiates something like 10 kilowatts to them with this 240-foot dish, 70-some-odd dB of gain. So there's a huge amount of power going to Voyager. Voyager is, in my opinion, a crystal diode front end. No low-noise amplifier. We didn't have any good, reliable low-noise amplifiers in 1977 when Voyager was launched. The most reliable thing you had is a mixer front end. So Voyager probably has something like an 8 dB noise figure receiver. The actual signal strength, because Voyager also has an extremely narrow band receiver. And by the way, you know exactly what frequency Voyager is on, because it doesn't depend on its local crystal oscillator reference for its phase lock loop. There is no phase lock loop there, so to speak. Let me drop it. The uplink signal from Goldstone becomes the reference signal for Voyager. It divides that by the ratio of 240 over 221 and sends that signal back down to you. So you know exactly what frequency it's on. You don't have to do a search. Well, you know the velocity that Voyager is moving, it tells you how much Doppler shift you get. And you know exactly what frequency you sent up to it 37 hours earlier. Round trip time up to Voyager and back is 37 hours at the speed of light. So you know exactly where to hit, where to place your 50 hertz bandwidth receiver so you hear Voyager. If you had to use a 50 hertz bandwidth receiver scanning a signal at 8.5 gigahertz, you and I would never find it if you didn't have all that given information. When I did that calculation, I seem to remember the signal strength that Voyager is getting is something like minus 160 dBm. I could go through the calculation again, Paul. I mean, Joe. It's around minus 160 dBm. You and I know that the weakest signal you can get out of a Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator is something like minus 110. So, 50 dB weaker than that. That's 100,000 times weaker than the weakest signal you can get out of a 608 signal generator. And you try to go weaker than that by using an external attenuator, you're wasting your time, because the leakage of the oscillator through the cabinet of the signal generator is going to be stronger than the signal you're sending through your testing setup, you know what I mean? But I'll do that calculation again, Paul. It's an interesting number. Vaguely remember, it's around minus 160 dBm. You and I don't have receivers anywhere near that sensitive, Joe. To be A2RYY, wait for the beep. K2RIW.
Can I have a question? Okay, and so it's 160 dBm effectively, that's the actual sensitivity of the receiver. That's the ultimate number. So someday, this thing's going to travel far enough where you just can't send enough power to hit the thing. You can put all the best receivers you want and the amplifiers on this end, but ultimately, it is going to get to a point where it simply can't hear you anymore. That would be correct. You need to estimate that it would be about 2022 or something like that. Yeah, that was what I was looking for. The receiver sensitivity at the lowest bandwidth minus the gain of the dish.
They said 2034, and then they want to upgrade down here again.
Once again, Paul, you're estimating that Voyager, we're going to listen to it in the year 2034. Let me think about that. 1977 to 2034, we're talking about something like 60 years of operation. That traveling wave tube and that nuclear power supply? Wow. Over to you, Paul.
I got that from an NASA site a while back. So we'll see how they do it. But they say they keep on upgrading down here. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it works out. Because they had major upgrades in the early 1980s on the antennas, and then the late 90s, they did the same thing with all these different detectors, like you said before. So, who knows if they're going to come up with another 5-10 years from now. Back to
the way I read this, Joe, is the gating item is downlink power. You're currently getting something in the vicinity of 10 watts out of that traveling wave tube from its nuclear power supply, and almost all the other instrumentation on board is turned off because the nuclear power supply, after 37 or 39 years, is slowly fading in power output. So downlink is the limit. And so therefore they've got to go pretty heroic of increasing the accuracy of the dish, increasing the diameter of the dish, increasing the sensitivity of the receiver, and so on. Ultimately, they may have to use the Great Big Green Bang Telescope dish, which is 1,000 feet in diameter, 100 meters in diameter. The 100-meter diameter dish at Green Bank, Virginia, is the most accurate, fully steerable dish. They may eventually have to use it, and maybe multiple dishes gang together electronically. You can have a dish in Coldstone, California, and a dish at Green Bank, West Virginia. And if you're smart enough in the way you make a broadband video recording, let me grab this. If you're smart enough in the way you make a very well documented, accurately timed broadband video recording of the IF strip out of Goldstone and the IF strip out of Green Bank, and bring them to a common place and play them together, electronically you're doing the equivalent of linking those two dishes, even though they're 2,000 miles apart. So you can do that, you can get almost a 3 dB increase in sensitivity. So increasing the downlink sensitivity, we have the technology to do that. As far as the sensitivity of the Goldstone, of the Voyager receiver, you can easily overcome that by using the bigger dish to do the transmitting on the ground. And instead of transmitting 10,000 watts to it, you transmit 50,000 watts, transmit 100,000 watts. So as long as you've got enough raw power down here, the uplink is usually not the limit, it's the downlink. There's no way you can increase the power output of Voyager. As the signal gets weaker and weaker to us because of greater and greater range, you tell Voyager to use less and less bit rate. If they go down to 25 bits per second instead of 50 bits per second, they can use a receiver that's 25 hertz wide and pick up 3 dB more sensitivity. So K2LYY, wait for the beeps, Joe, K2LYW.
And ultimately, as far as you know with the current technology, how high can you make a transmitter produce power at that frequency? That's asking a lot, isn't it? Going for something like 100 kilowatts at 8.5 gig?
That does exist, Dirja. It exists now as pulse power. And can you do some re-engineering of that tube to make it CW power? I think you can. And depending on what mode, what protocol you use to talk to Voyager, putting out pulses of energy at 100 kilowatts instead of a CW signal that you phase modulate, you may come out ahead if you do it just right. So The right way to do it is multiple dishes on receive. I don't think they've ever transmitted multiple dishes. In other words, assuming you had a real potent transmitter in Green Bank, West Virginia, and you've already got a potent transmitter at Goldstone, can you combine those two uplink transmitters? That's much more difficult. Doable, but I don't think they've done that. Combine dishes for receive, yes. And the motivation there is that on many of these spacecraft, you're downlink limited. Okay, we've used up our time. This was TechNet number 1629, with Space Report number 229. And I was much too severe with Christopher, KD2KZG. I was misinterpreting what he was saying. We frequently get messages from people saying, I wish you would do this instead of that. And stop talking technical. Well, hold on now. Excuse me. This is the technical net. And if that displeases you, then tune somewhere else. You've got 800 channels on your two-meter receiver. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. I should be kind to people. Over to you, John. KZ2WGB, K2IRW.
KZ2WGB. Very good, Dick. Good night. Night was interesting. As usual. I'd like to thank everybody for joining us, sending the questions in, and helping out with the mailbag. It's wonderful stuff. And by the way, Dick, how far would we have to move the 608 generator to equal with the existing receiver and antenna system you were talking about, to equal Voyager's strength? How far would we have to move that away from the dish at its minimum maximum attenuation?
That's been often done, John. It's called New England technique, because New England, I think it was, can't think of his name right now, the guy who was a real good ham radio operator in Swampscott, Massachusetts, W1FZJ, that could be his call letters, and before he started operating at the radio telescope in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, he would put the signal generator in the backyard on the end of about 100 feet of cable. The free space loss of the leakage from the cabinet of the signal generator from 100 feet away, that's another 45 dB of loss, free space loss. So you pick up 45 more dB of sensitivity by moving the signal generator far away with a cable coming into the laboratory, and you talk on a handy-talky to a guy who's twisting the dials on the signal generator. So you can always make a weaker signal. Worst comes to worst, you put the signal generator inside of screen room number one, and you do your testing in screen room number two. So making a weak signal weaker and still be calibratable, at first it sounds difficult. It's very doable. You just can't do it in one step with that distant attenuator on that signal generator. WS2N for final signals, 2034. So you read that one, Paul. WS2N, K2IW.
I probably read that about a year ago. We'll see how they do. And that's pretty much it. If you, you got one more show coming up, a show called Mars on the National Geographic station, so if you still get that, they're up to the third episode. Third is 3 out of 6, so after tomorrow night at 9 o'clock, we'll be halfway through that. 73 guys next week. John, over to you. KC2WGB, WS1.
Very good, gentlemen. We look forward to next week. And we'll solve all these mysteries. We'll give all the answers next week, like Dick says. KC2WGB, Blair.
Time is 12:04 p.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater.